Welcome back. I'm Kimberly Moffitt in for Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We want to start an interesting conversation about an issue that's been going on at least for a decade in our state, which speaks specifically to a particular legal case that is happening between the state of Maryland versus the Coalition for Equity and Excellence in Maryland Higher Education. We also, for those of us who are familiar with this case, we just simply refer to it as the Coalition case. And I have the esteemed pleasure of hosting four guests this morning who will share with us their perspectives and give us more information about what's happening with this particular case. But I want to encourage you as we engage or dive into this topic to call in with your comments at 410-319-8888, tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on the Mark Steiner Facebook page, or send us an email at talk@steinershow.org. So this morning I have Dr. George Lanoux in the studio with me. He is a research professor of political science as well as a research professor of public policy at UMBC and also the author of a recent Baltimore Sun op-ed piece entitled "A Maryland HBCU in Integration or Aggrandizement." Good morning, Dr. Lanoux.
Thank you.
And we also have in the studio Professor E.R. Shipp with us, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and journalist in residence, as well as an associate professor of journalism right here at Morgan State University. She, too, is the author of a recent Baltimore Sun op-ed piece entitled "Dueling Visions of Maryland's HBCUs." Good morning, Professor Shipp.
Good morning.
On the phone, I have Johnny Taylor, Jr., who is the president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, the only national organization representing nearly 300,000 students that are attending this country's 47 publicly supported HBCUs. Mr. Taylor.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. Thank you so much for joining us. And finally, we have Laszlo Boyd, who is the former education advisor to the governor of Maryland and also former acting secretary of higher education. Mr. Boyd, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? And I actually want to start with you because I know that you have a purview to be able to give us a great, greater context to this particular coalition case so that we understand exactly what it is that we're even discussing this morning. Could you please share?
Sure, I'll be happy to. The understanding exactly may be a tricky requirement.
Okay.
I think there are a lot of different views on this. And the good
Absolutely.
News about what you've asked me to do is you got some real experts there who I'm sure will be very able to correct any misstatements I make. This is a case that goes back a long way, as you suggested. The case was originally filed in 2006, but it really has its origins in 1992 when the Supreme Court ruled in a case widely referred to as the Fordyce case that came out of Mississippi that Mississippi and a number of other states, including Maryland, had the vestiges still in their system of segregated higher education. That decision in the Supreme Court case has led to a series of back and forth agreements and negotiations between the state of Maryland and the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education as to sort of remedies that the state would provide. In 2006, that coalition that you referred to, which is a coalition of alumni and students of the state's four HBCUs, filed a lawsuit. I think it's fair to say, although those are the plaintiffs and the defendant was the Maryland Higher Education Commission, there's a little bit of legal fiction going on here. The real adversaries in this case are, on the one hand, the four HBCUs, and particularly driven by the efforts of Morgan State and probably led by its former president, Earl Richardson, on the one hand, and the defendants, while it's really the state of Maryland and its willing and the approval process, in some ways the defendants are the other universities in the state who the coalition is asking to have changes made in their programs and their funding. The case first got argued, it sort of kicked back and forth for a while, started getting argued in 2011. Judge Catherine Blake, the federal court judge in, mm-hmm. in Baltimore, issued a decision in October of 2013. She ruled against the plaintiffs on two of their arguments. One was that the state underfunds the HBCUs. She found that, in fact, the state funds them quite well. She also ruled against the claim that their the argument that their mission statements, the purview of their scope of educational activities, was too narrow. She ruled against that, but she did rule in favor of them on the contention that there were shortages really in their program offerings, some coming from duplicated programs that had existed at both the HBCUs and historically white institutions on the one hand, and on the other, or in addition, that the HBCUs didn't have some of the high-demand programs that might have attracted more students and more diversity to their campuses. She issued that ruling in October of 2013, but didn't enter a final order. Rather, she said, go negotiate this and see if you can come to an agreement. That negotiation lasted for a better part of a year and got nowhere. So I'm almost to the end of the story. The next step was the plaintiffs in the case making a set of recommendations on how to remedy the problem, and they entered an extensive list of proposals, including merging the University of Baltimore into Morgan, taking away some programs from other states and finding some forms of augmentation of the program offerings at the four HBCUs, remembering that the four are very different in mission and in history. The state responded for the most part, rejected the plaintiff's proposals and came up with a set of suggestions that largely focused on creating a fund for collaborative programs among institutions, but also agreed to withdraw the joint UB Towson MBA that many people think precipitated the lawsuit. Whether that's right or not is a different question. So we're back to the judge now. Mm-hmm. The judge has to issue a ruling. Both two of your panelists have commented on, and I think thoughtfully and added to the discussion, on sort of where we are in terms of what is a standoff, the pleadings after the failure of a year of negotiations didn't close any of the gap. So Judge Blake has an interesting problem in front of her. And the last comment I'd make is that you can almost be certain that whoever prevails in Judge Blake's ruling, there will be an appeal to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond.
Which I think is fairly consistent with our two guests in the studio who would make the same claim. I want to ask one follow-up question before we have to let you go. I'm really curious in terms of the Maryland Higher Education Commission and their responsibility for ensuring that we avoid duplication of programs and we don't have these competing programs at various institutions. Do they play a role in this suit, or are they just cast aside and not being discussed because this is a much broader issue?
Well, I legally they have some role to play, but the sort of the decision making is way beyond them. I mean, one of the things to remember is that the Maryland Higher Education Commission is a court, in the parlance of higher education, is a coordinating board, not a governing board.
That's right.
So it has certain state responsibilities, but it doesn't govern any of the institutions. Do they play a role? I want to add one thing, and then I'm happy to turn it over. The phrase really isn't duplication. It's unnecessary duplication, which is a trickier standard. It doesn't say you can't have duplication. It really goes to a much more subjective standard of whether the duplication is unnecessary or not. There are lots of programs that, by their nature, in fact, most programs in undergraduate education are duplicated. Most, you know, places all have English departments. They all have history departments. They all have economics departments. So duplication isn't really the issue. It's unnecessary duplication, and it probably goes more to specializations than core curricula.
Okay. Okay. Thank you so much
sure.
for your perspective and that purview so that we can now dive in, which is why I actually want to go to Professor Shipp to start the conversation so that we can hear, in particular, as I read your op-ed piece, one of the final lines of that document I found most interesting, which I'd like to hear you expound upon a bit, where you say, what we have here are dueling visions of how to eradicate vestiges of a dual system. Talk to us.
Well, I was referring to the history that the judge related in her opinion back in October 2013, where she looks at how the black institutions, predominantly black institutions, came into being. They came into being because of the segregation policies of the state of Maryland. And specifically the University of Maryland. In her recounting of the history, she pointed out many opportunities that the state of Maryland had to provide quality education, higher education for blacks. And after many commissions have studied the situation and come up with recommendations, the state pretty much over time ignored most of those. If the state had followed some of the recommendations going back to the 1930s, we probably wouldn't be in the position we are now, where you've got the four traditionally black institutions saying that they've been underfunded. The judge didn't accept that, as the previous guest said, but that they have been denied the opportunity to develop these high-demand programs that would attract students no matter what their race. Mm. So the predominantly black institutions, historically black institutions, are saying that they want to be first-class institutions, not limited in what they can offer and to whom they can offer those programs. They want to be able to have specializations that would attract students across the board. The response of the state seems to be looking at them in a more limited way, that they will continue to function pretty much as they are now, and that the best we can hope for is that by exposing high school students to the HBCUs, that some students, meaning white students in particular, might find them attractive. But the state's proposal would not essentially change the dynamics of the universities as they exist now.
Okay. Dr. Lanoux, share with us, I mean, because I know you have a perspective on this as well, and I want to make sure that it's clear that I am disclaiming that although serving as guest host today, I am a colleague of Dr. Lanoux's and a faculty member at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, but certainly serving clearly as a moderator today and staying in my lane as a faculty member and faculty member only. Yes, Dr. Lanoux, offer your perspective, and then I'm also interested in responding to some aspects of your op-ed piece.
Thank you. I think no one can disagree about the history of segregation in the state of Maryland. That's a fact. The question is, what's the right remedy? The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment says no person shall be denied equal protection of the law, and there is no longer any dispute that any student of any racial background who has the qualifications can be admitted to any of Maryland's public higher education institutions. That has led to a situation where at a number of Maryland's higher education institutions, there are very large numbers of minority students at UMBC. Last year's freshman class was 49% white. At the University of Baltimore, about 40% of the students are African American and about 40% are white. The largest number of African American students in the state attend the University of Maryland University College. Almost 60% of African American students attend non-HBCUs, if you're considering only state universities. If you consider private universities and community colleges, it's into 80%. So this is no longer a situation, the classic Southern situation, where African American students could not be admitted or were not treated well at historically white institutions. The playing field has changed enormously, And so the question the court had to decide was whether there had been unfairly restricted missions for the HBCUs, and it decided that that wasn't the case. It had to decide whether HBCUs were denied appropriate capital funding. The court decided that wasn't the case. It had to decide whether HBCUs were underfunded in terms of per capita student allocations, and that not only wasn't the case, HBCUs have been funded much better than non-HBCUs. So the only remaining question is, could we have more integration if the program allocations in the state had been different? And the court ruled that that question had to be looked at. The state at that time had not presented an expert witness on that subject. It now has. Alan Lichtman, a professor at American University, has written a, I think it's a 200-page report on program duplication, arguing that there isn't a pattern of program duplication and that the remedies the coalition produced would, in fact, not lead to much more integration in higher education and might severely damage those institutions that are already highly integrated.
So I want to there's so much more that we need to get into here, and I need to hear from Mr. Taylor, but I also want to hear from one of our callers. Donna, please stay with us. But we've got to run to break very quickly, and we'll be right back to talk about these issues. On our way to the break, I want to remind you to join Mark Steiner on January 13th for the 13th annual Annapolis Summit at the Governor Calvert House on the opening day of the state legislature in Annapolis. It's your chance to have your questions answered when we talk with Governor Larry Hogan, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush. Save your seat and get more information about sponsorships at thedailyrecord.com/Annapolis-summit or by contacting Morgan Cook at 443-524-8181 or morgan.cook@thedailyrecord.com. The Annapolis Summit is sponsored by the Daily Record, the Maryland State Education Association, Stevenson University, Alexander and Cleaver, VPC, the John Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and WEAA. Be a part of the Annapolis Summit by calling 443-524-8181. We'll be right back to continue our conversation about HBCUs and PWIs in Maryland. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Kimberly Moffitt, sitting in for Mark Steiner here for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We left off hearing perspectives from both Professor Shipp and Dr. Lanoue about where the parties or that are involved in this coalition case stand. But I also wanted to bring Johnny Taylor into the conversation, who again is president and CEO of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, which is considered the only national organization representing nearly 300,000 students attending this country's 47 publicly supported HBCUs. Mr. Taylor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, you know, one of the downsides to being last is, of course, everyone's covered your material.
But I know you have something to offer.
But no, what I would say to you is frankly, everything that's been said so far by my fellow panelists is incredibly is accurate in its own way, which is the very point. That's why we're at this point.
Exactly.
It's because reasonable minds can differ about what is the right way to look at this. But what I'd like to add to this, however, is you have to add just a little bit more flavor to the historical context and the judge's findings in the context of that context. So, you know, people aren't talking about, we all sort of agree that the state of Maryland has had an interesting, and let's call it that, experience as it struggled through diversity and equal opportunity in higher education, going back as far as the 40s when the Marbury Commission initially declared that the state, it said, has consistently pursued a policy of providing higher education for Negroes, which is inferior to whites, and establishing inferior academic programs at HBCUs. That was sort of the premise of it. All of this, you know, in its own commission in 1947, the state of Maryland essentially said, we have a problem here. And, you know, 20 years post that, the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights came in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and literally threatened to cut off federal funding to the state as a result of its treatment of HBCUs. And so now fast forward another 30 years. And in 2000, the state of Maryland finally entered into an agreement, a consent decree, with the Office of Civil Rights, the United States, the federal level, and said that it wouldn't do certain things, including unnecessarily duplicating programs. Well, fast forward 2006, 6 years after the consent decree was entered into, Judge Blake found, and that's the critical point here, there has been a finding of fact that the state did not follow through on its commitments to the federal government that it agreed to in the negotiated consent decree. And what I think can't be lost on the listening audience is there's some information. When you talk about unnecessary duplication and its impact on HBCUs, Judge Blake specifically, as a matter of law, determined that. She cited a 73% decline in white graduate enrollment at Coppin State University, a 67% decrease at Bowie State University. In fact, she talked about Bowie State had a master's in computer science program. She described it as it dropped precipitously from 119 students to 24 after the state duplicated the program at another majority institution in the state. I guess what she was responding to and reacting to is the state appears not to be acting in good faith. I mean, from 1947 forward, despite several different bodies, its own commissions, federal judges, federal judges and the Department of Education, Office of Civil Rights, each of them have said, okay, here we are. We're now 60 years later singing the same song. There is a problem.
And I also want to make sure we hear the perspective that the situation Maryland is in right now is not unique. It's also
That's
a
right.
part of a national conversation or trend that we see happening. So where does that come from?
Well, and that's why this case is so critical. We're considering cases like this cases in the state of Georgia, for example. Several of our southern states, Alabama, the alumni groups there are considering this, and I do want to point out that the reason that many of these cases are being brought by alumni groups, as was initially noted at the beginning of this interview, is because you think about it. In a state institution, you work for the state. So the president of the university is in quite the precarious position. If you're the president of a public HBCU, you're hard-pressed to bite the hand that's feeding you, even if what you're being fed is not exactly, you know, nutrient-rich and consistent with what you think you should deserve. So it requires groups of alumni and students and organizations like ours
to be the voice.
The Marshall College Fund to advance these arguments. But to your point, the reality is this case is being watched closely by the entire country because we think Maryland is sort of a test case. It's the litmus case. We are wanting to follow this, and most of the states are saying, let's see what this judge has found. And frankly, there was a collective sense of relief in the HBCU community when the Maryland judge did, you know, conclude what she made the conclusions that she drew. And what we are appreciative of, frankly, is that as opposed to just handing down a decision, she said, okay, parties, I've, as this independent trier of fact, has concluded that, in fact, there is a problem here. Now, you go back and try and work it out. What is unfortunate is that the state has come back with a paltry $10 million over 6 years and, frankly, take some students in the high school level and introduce them to Morgan State or Coppin State or Bowie State, hoping that ultimately they'll consider those institutions to attend. Well, if you offer inferior programs or non-high-demand programs, no matter how positive their experience is, a high school student's experience is, visiting a campus and having a summer STEM program, for example, if the better program is ultimately at UMBC, then that's where you're going to enroll. So that's the struggle, is that what the state has proposed, at least in our opinion, and this is a national perspective, is absolutely consistent with what they've done since 1947, and it's disingenuous.
Okay. All right. So I want to go to Donna, who's been holding for a while and has a perspective to offer, and then I want to come back to my studio guests, who I'm certain have a response to what Mr. Taylor has offered. Donna, welcome.
Hi. You're doing an excellent, excellent show.
Thank you so much for holding.
I'm a graduate of Morgan, up to graduate school. And I was, when I was there, Schaefer came on campus. And when he saw, when he was governor, when he saw the conditions that Morgan was in, when he saw the duplication of programs, and maybe Dr. Taylor can, or Mr. Taylor can correct me, he was the one who started pushing for non-duplication of programs. And it's when he went out as governor that seemed the duplication of programs all of a sudden started coming back. The point I want to make is, in my travels in different schools, taking a class or two, white students still have the biggest fear of going to an African-American school. And they tell me, because it's unsafe, you know, it's inferior education. You know, so I have, you know, that still proliferates to this day. Another case, another issue is, we got to look at, Morgan has always been a school where people of color and religious groups could come and teach there without having to face obstacles of racism and culture biases and whatever. Morgan is the most diverse university, I would say, in Maryland, maybe throughout the country, because we have professors from all over the world. I was taught by every professor from every walk of life in the world. Also, Morgan had a large Jewish population of professors who were denied to come to Morgan, I mean, to go to other schools,
right,
because
historically
they were Jewish.
Yes.
So I wanted your guests to talk about that, because, I mean, we have a long history. Morgan was the center of where women, white women, could come and teach, because they were denied our ability to go and teach other schools, Jewish professors, Middle Eastern professors, et cetera. Morgan is still a diverse university internationally, and I think we need to get credit for that. Just because you have a few African Americans at a predominantly white school does not mean you're a diverse university, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Donna. Dr. Lanou, if you would like to respond to that, or certainly address any aspects of what Mr. Taylor has also offered.
Judge Blake has to work within the constitutional limits of her office. The Constitution does not require that HBCUs and non-HBCUs are equal institutions. It does not require that Bowie State be equal to the University of Maryland College Park. It does not require that Morgan be equal to Towson or UMBC.
What do we mean by equal?
Well, in the Bohannon Commission, it referred to comparable and competitive. That was language that was attractive politically, but it's something like the No Child Left Behind language. It says every child should be competent educationally by the year 2014. There are differences in the way institutions select students, in the way they select faculty, and in their graduation rates and in their SAT scores. It isn't possible through funding changes or program changes to simply alter those realities. Now, there are some hard questions that need to be faced. If we're going to have more integration in the state, there are some ways to do that without closing down programs, without transferring programs. I have suggested that the state fund joint research projects between faculty at HBCUs and non-HBCUs, joint student activities. There's no reason why students from Towson or UMBC or Coppin or Morgan can't collaborate in trying to solve environmental problems, educational deficiency problems, criminal justice problems. There ought to be lectureships so that Professor Shipp can come over and lecture at non-HBCUs, and perhaps someone would invite me to lecture at an HBCU, so that students are exposed to diverse ideas and students from different kinds of backgrounds that they have. But to try to simply take over the University of Baltimore to eliminate the academic programs at University of Maryland, University College, or to pull out information systems programs and engineering programs from UMBC and move them is a remedy that isn't constitutionally appropriate.
So because we also recognize that recently University of Baltimore and Towson decided to no longer host their joint MBA program. So you're not suggesting a proliferation of more joint programs, but more cross-collaboration among the schools.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Professor Shipp.
Well, there are any number of things that could be pursued here. But I think what the coalition litigants are saying is that you have to address the problem. You have to correct the problem that's here. The unnecessary duplication, if you're going to correct that, that's going to necessarily mean that there's going to be some pain on the side of those whose programs are going to be eliminated or forced to merge with Morgan and the other HBCUs. It seems to me that the state or the predominantly white institutions want to hold on to everything that they have, ignoring the fact that some of those programs came into existence because they were trying to undermine what was going on at the HBCUs. So addressing that problem.
And can you offer examples for us?
The business school MBA program was what was highlighted by the judge in her decision, that that program, when introduced at Morgan, was unique and was in high demand. Those are key words that they like to use here. And it was undermined by a program that was then established at University of Baltimore but extended to Towson.
After the fact.
Yeah. And so it's those kinds of things, and I think they've gone through other programs to see similar kinds of history, that you've got to address that. So if you go back to the time before the duplication, that's going to mean pain. It's going to mean some change at University of Baltimore, at UMBC, they're going to have to lose something. The question is, what is that going to be? When is going to be? What's the timetable? But something is going to have to change. And Professor Lanoue, I know you're saying it's going to be too cumbersome and too costly and those kinds of things. And it will be those things, but I don't think it's an impossibility to still address this notion of unnecessary duplication by taking some programs from some of the PWIs, that's a term I just learned in the last couple of years, from the PWIs and giving them to the HWIs is what they're called in the HBIs is what they're called in the lawsuit. But in any case, taking them from the predominantly white institutions, the historically white institutions, and transfer them to the historically black ones.
I would also add, you know, one of the things that I struggle with, and I take Dr. Lanoue's point, questioning whether or not the judge overreached. Again, that's for a court to decide. We all have I have an opinion, he has an opinion, all of us have opinions about that. What I would submit to you, though, is more in the context of a breach of contract theory. And that is, and I think Judge Blake, while she didn't explicitly say that, she said, you entered into an agreement, a consent decree with the Department of Education, Maryland. And part of that said that you agreed to remedy the disparity in high-demand programs and to stop undercutting HBC enrollment by unnecessarily duplicating their programs. So you cannot now turn around. I mean, the reality is that was the deal. If you disagreed at that time, if your argument was the federal government had overreached and it had no right under the Constitution to drag you into court, then fight that battle. But once you sign this consent decree and you agree that I am going to act consistently with it, then I'm really struggling with it. I think that's what Judge Blake was struggling with, is you've agreed that there's a problem here, or at least you've agreed to fix the problem, whether or not you agree it's constitutional or not. And now here we are 6 or 7 years later, 2006 when this case started, and you're continuing to engage in the same behavior that brought us to this point. That, to me, is a really – that's the essence of the argument.
And so I want to push back on all three of you to just kind of play with this piece of, you know, when we talk about K-12 education, we get so caught up in the bureaucracy, and the one thing that many pundits push back on to suggest gets lost is the very constituent or stakeholder that we're responsible for, which would be the students. So I want to ask that same question, or at least ponder it with the three of my guests now, in terms of what is the focus of this suit on our students, and how is it benefiting or taking away from our students to continue with this level of litigation?
Well, nobody knows because the students aren't really asked, but for students that have made the decision to attend one school, have applied there, have friends there, have begun their work there, or who have become alumni, and suddenly to have the programs that they've enrolled in move to another place, or in the case of the University of Baltimore, end their institutional identity altogether, seems to me to be a unnecessary burden on those students.
Okay. Professor Shea.
And then I would say, let me chime in here. So
sure.
what would the student who enrolled in Coppin State University, or let's go to Bowie State University, you enrolled in a master's in computer science program that at the time, whether you're African American or Caucasian American, had 119 Caucasian students in it. So you had some level of diversity, and therefore you enrolled in Bowie State University. Well, then the state says, so let me go unnecessarily duplicate the program across the street, which eliminated the diversity that you found attractive, as well as the master's in computer science program that you found attractive at Bowie State, and you took it somewhere else. I would argue that that student was harmed as a result of the state's decision. That's just as compelling, and frankly, that's why some of these students who are now alums, they were, in fact, students at the time, they said they were harmed as a result of this.
I think the idea is that ultimately all the students will benefit. It may not be this particular generation of students because they're going to have to go through the transition, whatever the decision ultimately is. But the goal is to come up with a system that is more equitable and that benefits all students.
And so at the extent of, because I know part of some of the discussion around proposals that are out there are, for instance, for some of the HBCUs to actually assume completely other institutions. And so even in that instance, do we see that as benefiting students?
It could. That's the argument. It could. It would strengthen those programs. It would eliminate duplication. That's more of a bureaucratic kind of thing, bureaucratic kind of thing. But it would ultimately strengthen the programs, I think.
And I'm actually one who while I'm less, and this is probably controversial, but I'm not a part in this, but I'm less interested in transferring programs as I and more interested in ensuring that future high-demand academic programs are allowed at HBCUs and then not subsequently unnecessarily duplicated.
So there's a
case to be said for, I think there is quite, you know, I could see a student who's enrolled at UMBC saying, I don't want to be forced to now enroll at Morgan State because the state just decides as a result of this litigation to move me. I get that. But which is why we have been on a national level prompting the creation of high demand academic programs at HBCU. So I'm not taking the program from another school. I'm creating these programs at HBCUs so that they are not consistently given inferior programs.
So then does that start us at a point where we forget about the history and just start from the point we are now and move forward? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I think it's because of that history that you do it. For example, in Judge Blake's decision, she said that, you know, the disparity in high demand academic programs at predominantly white institutions, there are 122 of them in the state of Maryland versus 11 at the state's HBCUs. That's huge. 10% of the high demand academic programs exist on HBCU campuses. One has to wonder how that just happened.
Well, I can respond to that. One of the non-HBCUs is the University of Maryland College Park, which has more than 25,000 students, and it has a position in the state of being a flagship and being nationally competitive. And so, obviously, it has more programs than the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, which is a much smaller institution. Which has a different student body, dramatically different graduation rates, and plays a different role in the state system. So the fact that there are more high-demand programs at institutions which are labeled racially now, even though the actual institutions are quite diverse and fully integrated, is because of the nature of the educational missions of those institutions and not because of their race.
No, I wouldn't say it was because of the race, but I would clearly say you can't suggest that, because the judge even said this, while funding has been, you know, there's no question, and maybe I should ask it differently. Are you arguing that there's no instance of historical underfunding in the state of Maryland as between an HBCU and College Park?
College Park is the best funded institution in the state.
My point. There's no way you can say, oh, so one's 25,000 students is one is 2,500 students. Oh, yeah, but we hella funded the 25,000 student institution. You wonder why it is that's really the essence of the argument. So I don't think we can throw away the history.
Let me put some facts into this. The state FTE appropriation per student appropriation at College Park is $12,945. At Coppin, it's $11,000. At Morgan, it's $11,000. At UMBC, it's about $8,600. And at Towson, it's about $5,000. Hmm. So there is not a pattern here based on race of the state appropriation to students.
That's grossly unfair. You're saying what is the current FTE? I'm talking historical. You know, the reason it's lower now at an institution like UMBC is largely because, I mean, if you were funded so significantly in the future such that you got better students, better faculty, better facilities, then you rely less on state funding, right? I mean, you can't take a snapshot right now and just say right now, if we look at FTE right now, those schools, Morgan State, is funded better than UMBC and think that's the right level of analysis.
Well, here's the other fact. Since 1984, HBCUs received $1,800 more per student than TWIs. So it's been I wouldn't argue that was true in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s.
Right.
But since 1984, the state has put more money into HBIs than to TWIs.
So if I can have just as concluding remarks from the two of you, because we know we're in such a contentious space right now around the coalition case that it doesn't look like we're getting to a point of compromise or even final decision. And in fact, there was a Inside Higher Ed piece that already says to us that we should anticipate appeal to a higher court in the future. If I can get a response from both of you as we're closing.
Well, I think the case will be appealed because the law is unsettled. The way universities have responded to the diversity question and integrating their student bodies is fundamentally different now than it was 20 years ago and certainly than it was 40 years ago. I like the idea of being prospective in a remedy. Rather than trying to dismantle existing institutions or existing programs.
Mr. Taylor, 10 seconds.
Albert Einstein said it best, compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. Okay? So the idea that these institutions have been well-funded for 50, 60 years and have enjoyed the benefit of compound interest means they have not been fairly treated. And frankly, that's why you develop remedies such as the ones that are proposed here.
Thank you so much. I want to thank my guest, Professor Shipp, who is an associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University, Dr. George Lanoux, who is a research professor of political science and public policy at UMBC, Johnny Taylor, who is president and CEO of Thurgood Marshall College Fund, and certainly Laszlo Boyd, who was with us in the first part of the show. I'm Kimberly Moffitt, sitting in for Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll listen to a brand new episode of Soundbites. On our way to break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.meq.com. Thanks so much for joining us and enjoy the day.